3. The Lure of the Flame. The music mounted with the flame, and I understood now its recurrent ebb and flow. As I looked and listened, a mad thought was born in my mind. The thought of how marvelous and ecstatical it would be to run forward and leap headlong into the singing fire. The music seemed to tell me that I should find, in that moment of flaring dissolution, all the delight and triumph, all the splendor and exultation it had promised from afar. It besought me. It pleaded with tones of supernal melody, and, despite the wadding in my ears, the seduction was well nigh irresistible. However, it had not robbed me of all sanity. With a sudden start of terror, like one who has been tempted to fling himself from a high precipice, I drew back. Then I saw that the same dreadful impulse was shared by some of my companions. The two entities with scarlet wings, whom I have previously mentioned, were standing a little apart from the rest of us. Now, with a great fluttering, they rose and flew toward the flame like moths toward a candle. For a brief moment, the light shone redly through their half-transparent wings ere they disappeared in the leaping incandescence which flared briefly and then burned as before. Then, in rapid succession, a number of other beings, who represented the most divergent trends of biology, sprang forward and immolated themselves in the flame. There were creatures with translucent bodies, and some that shone with all the hues of the opal. There were winged colossi, and titans who strode as with seven-league boots. And there was one being with useless abortive wings, who crawled rather than ran, to seek the same glorious doom as the rest. But among them there were none of the city's people. These merely stood and looked on, impassive and statue-like as ever. I saw that the fountain had now reached its greatest height, and was beginning to decline. It shrank steadily but slowly to half its former elevation. During this interval there were no more acts of self-sacrifice, and several of the beings beside me turned abruptly and went away, as if they had overcome the lethal spell. One of the tall, armored entities, as he left, addressed me in words that were like clarion notes, with unmistakable accents of warning. By a mighty effort of will, in a turmoil of conflicting emotions, I followed him. At every step, the madness and delirium of the music warred with my instincts of self-preservation. More than once I started to go back. My homeward journey was blurred and doubtful as the wanderings of a man in opium trance. And the music sang behind me, and told me of the rapture I had missed, of the flaming dissolution whose brief instant was better than aeon of mortal life. August 9th. I have tried to go on with a new story, but have made no progress. Anything that I can imagine or frame in language seems flat and puerile beside the world of unsearchable mystery to which I have found admission. The temptation to return is more cogent than ever. The call of that remembered music is sweeter than the voice of a loved woman. And always I am tormented by the problem of it all, and tantalized by the little which I have perceived and understood. What forces are these whose existence and working I have merely apprehended? Who are the inhabitants of the city? And who are the beings that visit the enshrined flame? What rumor or legend has drawn them from outland realms and ulterior planets to that place of inerrable danger and destruction? And what is the fountain itself? What is the secret of its lure and its deadly singing? These problems admit of infinite surmise, but no conceivable solution. I am planning to go back once more, but not alone. Someone must go with me, this time, as a witness to the wonder and the peril. It is all too strange for credence. I must have human corroboration of what I have seen and felt, and conjectured. Also, another might understand where I have failed to do more than apprehend. Who shall I take? it will be necessary to invite someone here from the outside world, someone of high intellectual and aesthetic capability. Shall I ask Philip Hastane, my fellow fiction writer? He would be too busy, I fear. But there is the Californian artist, Felix Ebonley, who has illustrated some of my fantastic novels. Ebonley would be the man to see and appreciate the new dimension, if he can come. With his bent for the bizarre and unearthly, the spectacle of that plain and city, the Babylon buildings and arcades, and the Temple of the Flame, will simply enthrall him. I shall write immediately to his San Francisco address. August 12th. Ebonley is here. The mysterious hints in my letter regarding some novel pictorial subjects along his own line were too provocative for him to resist. Now I have fully explained and given him a detailed account of my adventures. I can see that he is a little incredulous, for which I can hardly blame him. But he will not remain incredulous for long, for tomorrow we shall visit together the city of the Singing Flame. August 13th. I must concentrate my disordered faculties, must choose my words and write with exceeding care. This will be the last entry in my journal, and the last writing I shall ever do. When I have finished, I shall wrap the journal up and address it to Philip Hastane, who can make such disposition of it as he sees fit. I took Ebonley into the other dimension today. He was impressed, even as I had been, by the two isolated boulders on Crater Ridge. They looked like the guttered ends of columns, established by prehuman gods, he remarked. I begin to believe you now. I told him to go first, and indicated the place where he should step. He obeyed without hesitation, and I had the singular experience of seeing a man melt into utter instantaneous nothingness. One moment he was there. The next there was only bare ground, and the far-off tamaracks, whose view his body had obstructed. I followed, and found him standing, in speechless awe, on the violet grass. "This," he said at last, "is the sort of thing whose existence I have hitherto merely suspected, and have never been able to hint at in my most imaginative drawings." We spoke little as we followed the range of monolithic boulders toward the plain. Far in the distance, beyond those high and stately trees, with their sumptuous foliage, the golden-brown vapors had parted, showing vistas of an immense horizon, and past the horizon were range on range of gleaming orbs and fiery flying motes in the depths of that amber heaven. It was as if the veil of another universe than ours had been drawn back. We crossed the plain and came at length within earshot of the siren music. I warned Ebonley to stuff his ears with cotton wadding, but he refused. "I don't want to deaden any new sensations I may experience," he observed. We entered the city. My companion was in a veritable rhapsody of artistic delight when he beheld the enormous buildings and the people. I could see, too, that the music had taken hold upon him. His look soon became fixed and dreamy as that of an opium-eater. At first he made many comments on the architecture and the various beings who passed us, and called my attention to details which I had not perceived before. However, as we drew nearer the Temple of the Flame, his observational interest seemed to flag, and was replaced by more and more of an aesthetic inward absorption. His remarks became fewer and briefer, and he did not even seem to hear my questions. It was evident that the sound had wholly bemused and bewitched him. Even as on my former visit there were many pilgrims going toward the shrine, and few that were coming away from it, most of them belonged to evolutionary types that I had seen before. Among those that were new to me, I recall one gorgeous creature with golden and carillion wings like those of a giant Lepidoptera, and scintillating, jewel-like eyes that must have been designed to mirror the glories of some Edenic world. I felt, too, as before, the captatious thraldom and bewitchment, the insidious, gradual perversion of thought and instinct, as if the music were working in my brain like a subtle alkaloid. Since I had taken my usual precaution, my subjugation to the influence was less complete than that of Ebb only. But, nevertheless, it was enough to make me forget a number of things, among them the initial concern which I had felt when my companion refused to employ the same mode of protection as myself. I no longer thought of his danger, or my own, except as something very distant and immaterial. The streets were like the prolonged and bewildering labyrinth of a nightmare, but the music led us forthrightly, and always there were other pilgrims. Like men in the grip of some powerful current, we were drawn to our destination. As we passed along the hall of gigantic columns, and neared the abode of the fiery fountain, a sense of our peril quickened momentarily in my brain, and I sought to warn Ebb only once more. But all my protests and remonstrances were futile. He was deaf as a machine, and wholly impervious to anything but the lethal music. His expression and movements were those of a somnambulist. Even when I seized and shook him with such violence as I could muster, he remained oblivious of my presence. The throng of worshippers was larger than upon my first visit. The jet of pure incandescent flame was mounting steadily as we entered, and it sang with the pure ardor and ecstasy of a star alone in space. Again, with ineffable tones, it told me the rapture of a moth-like death in its lofty soaring, the exultation and triumph of a momentary union with its elemental essence. The flame rose to its apex, and even for me the mesmeric lure was well nigh irresistible. Many of our companions succumbed, and the first to immolate himself was the giant Lepidopterous being. Four others of diverse evolutional types followed in appallingly swift succession. In my own partial subjugation to the music, my own efforts to resist that deadly enslavement, I had almost forgotten the very presence of Ebb only. It was too late for me to even think of stopping him, when he ran forward, in a series of leaps that were both solemn and frenzied, like the beginnings of some sacerdotal dance, and hurled himself headlong into the flame. The fire enveloped him. It flared up for an instant with a more dazzling greenness, and that was all. Slowly, as if from benumbed brain centers, a horror crept upon my conscious mind, and helped to annul the perilous mesmerism. I turned, while many others were following Ebb only's example, and fled from the shrine and from the city. But somehow the horror diminished as I went. More and more I found myself envying my companion's fate, and wondering as to the sensations he had felt in that moment of fiery dissolution. Now, as I write this, I am wondering why I came back again to the human world. Words are futile to express what I have beheld and experienced, and the change that has come upon me, beneath the play of incalculable forces in a world of which no other mortal is even cognizant. Literature is nothing more than a shadow. Life, with its drawn-out length of monotonous reiterative days, is unreal and without meaning now, in comparison with the splendid death which I might have had, the glorious doom which is still in store. I have no longer any will to fight the ever-insistent music which I hear in memory, and there seems to be no reason at all why I should fight it. Tomorrow I shall return to the city.